Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Every stroke counts on the scorecard and every penny counts in the market. That's why TD Ameritrade is committed to straightforward pricing with no surprises, so you're free to swing with confidence. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg. Member SIPC. We are back with another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is part two of our most recent conversation with up-and-coming golf architect Jaeger Kovich. So if you missed part one, check it out. It was released last week. We talk a ton about how Jaeger got into the profession of golf architecture, playing golf around New York and A.W. Tillinghast. In this edition, we go over Jaeger's Mount Rushmore. We bring back overrated, underrated. There's all kinds of good stuff in this this half of the podcast. Really appreciate the time from Jaeger. He also has been writing a ton for the website. Him and Clyde Johnson have been doing the Eclectic 18 of the UK. Highly recommend checking it out. This week, we will be hitting hole 16. So if you haven't read any of them, you got a lot of reading ahead, and they do a really great job breaking down each hole, 1 through 18, all different holes from different golf courses around the UK. So definitely check that out on the website, thefriedegg.com. And here's part two of Jaeger Kovich.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
We've talked Tillinghast and we've talked Tom Simpson.
Yeah.
I'm assuming those two would be on your Mount Rushmore. Four guys. If you had to do four. Who'd be the other two if you I don't want to put either of those guys on if you don't think they deserve to be on there.
I don't know. I guess love sports talk radio, and this is like the classic, you know, Mount Rushmore question.
Mount Rushmore, it's I ask it to so many people. I just ask it.
I'd probably put Tom on there. His influence with the writing and not just his golf courses, which the portfolio certainly speaks for itself and probably belongs on there. Just because of that, but I think the impact in the with the books, both the Anatomy and the Conventional Guide, and just showing people or trying to the modern day, it just shows you how many great golf courses there are around the world that people didn't really know about, and you know people are going all over the place to see them because you know he put these places on the sort of map again. I think that impact that way is pretty enormous.
And writing about restoration, like how many clubs did he write like this could be great if it was restored, like, and then it led those clubs to actually do something.
Mm-hmm. Or just the Anatomy too, just you know, it's just the perfect book to give to like your green chair or something like that, right? It's like 101. It's, you know, not the super old English like the old guys, but it's in very easy to understand. Well, at least I think so. But I think even the guy that's really interested in the golf can probably read that architectural book and, I mean, learn a gazillion things from it too. Even though if they don't understand everything, there'll be parts they take and then they'll play more and more. And if you pick it up 5 years later, you probably learn something totally new too. So,
I always recommend that or Shackelford's Grounds for Golf.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually love the little red book too.
That was neat.
I think it's really easy for people with like ADD like me.
Or if you grew up on Golf Club Alice, I'm like, yeah, I remember that thread. I remember when it was.
That too.
Right. That's how I took it.
It doesn't have some of the snarky replies.
Those are good too. he shockingly likes like emojis on there too, which is kind of funny.
It is kind of fun. Bill Core likes emojis too.
Guy doesn't have email, but he loves the text. It's pretty funny.
It is funny. It's really funny. Doesn't even know how to use the internet. But
it's funny too because he's like, the last time he's like, hey, hi, this is Bill. Like, he's like, are you comfortable texting? I'm like, I'm 33, man. You're like, yeah, I can do this. Been doing this for a while. I mean, he's a candidate too, for sure, right? I don't know. I mean, Mackenzie, you'd probably be on there with the continental stuff, just all over the globe. That's a pretty important one too. How many is that?
That's four.
Is that four if we have Tilly on there?
Are you booting Tilly?
I don't know.
You can boot him. Don't feel like you have to have him on there.
We'll leave it for now. I mean, you could put. I have a total fascination with Walter Travis courses as well. He would probably be a candidate for me. I probably wouldn't have Ross over Tilly. I think Tilly's best work is sort of a step of like the whole chunk of that A-level Tilly stuff, I think, is a little over that sort of class from Ross. I think Ross has some like a top three or five which are up there, but after that it's kind of, you know, that sort of perfect every community has to have one of those Donald Ross courses, which is awesome, right? The volume.
That's the tricky thing to weigh, is like the prolificness,
but it's important. And you know,
I guess mean, this is a good question for you.
You could questionably have, you know, Trent Jones on there just because of what he did business-wise to the thing. I mean, you could have it
Cold.
On there. Mm-hmm, exactly. That was the next one from the UK. Or, Old Tom, or like those, you know, the guys that were just finding the, like, you know, if you wanted to go with that, Old Tom's resume is pretty damn good too, right?
So would you, let's take like Tom Simpson career. Nobody's ever going to be Donald Ross, but like, say you did instead of what Tom Simpson's 20 courses,
something like that.
George Thomas would be another one that's in that same bucket.
There's a guy that, you know, is another candidate for you, but yeah.
Would you rather have like that type of career or a like three times as many, but not have as good, the great ones, like not have as many great ones, all really, you know.
I'm just trying to have a career.
I understand that, but you know, I'm just curious. I never really thought.
It's such a different business now. It is. Nobody. I can't see any scenario where anybody's going to have anything close to that, right? So in scaled reality, you know, if anyone, you know, start the clocks now, does like 40 or 50 courses in their career, it's going to be insane, right?
10's a lot.
It is. You know, even if like, you know, like look at, you know, it's changed in the last 5 years, but historically, if you look at say like Gil, he doesn't have like the world's longest list of new courses. Certainly the last 5-10 years would probably, you know, it's fresher in your minds, the new things, so, and they're prevalent and they're all awesome. But it's, the business has changed, and it took years and years and years of great renovation, restoration, and the odd, really cool new courses he built. But to get to that point, it's so hard to tell now. It would be amazing to just do one right now, and I'm probably not even gonna, you know, who knows what that property is gonna like, so it's impossible.
I think because like this is a conversation that you have about tour golfers, like would you rather be the guy that has like, you know, the 25-year career but doesn't win a ton, or a guy that wins, you know, a lot but mm-hmm. a shorter career. Like, yeah. you know, it's like that it's a crazy thing, because, like, I don't know. That's kind of what spurned my thought.
Could like Clayton Kershaw, right? You do the best renovation restorations of all time, but when you get the new stuff, it just doesn't add up and it doesn't translate.
Yeah.
You know, right? Sorry, Shackelford.
That's a good. I like that. It's Clayton Kershaw. It's I don't know. It's I agree, because then
I just don't want to be the Mets.
Or the Cubs.
True, right?
The Cubs are worse, but we've been good lately. You know?
Yeah.
So in your position, you get getting the first one's the toughest thing.
Yeah, and then after that, it feels like getting the second one, because so you're not just the, you know, one time. You know, you got lucky one time. You know, you did something good enough that someone wants to work. You know, wants to use you again, right? That's okay. It wasn't a fluke,
yeah,
kind of thing. You know, that supplants it. You know, anyone can get lucky once, I guess.
It's in the development world too. It's so hard at this point. I think developers that they're in this position where they almost feel like there's not too much work for the top guys. So like they're always available and they think like, oh, why would we like, there's no risk in hiring, you know, Gil, Tom or Bill, Bill, like
you're getting the highest quality stuff.
Yeah.
Every time.
And there's no smart, safe choice. But you know, when Mike Kaiser changed everything, when he hired David Kidd, mm-hmm. David Kidd was a extremely risky hire.
Yeah.
And it's just a fascinating thing, because at that time there was so much development going on that you could, well, like Fazio is going to be so busy that he wouldn't spend a ton of time here. Like, and that's not the case right now, which is a very interesting thing for the,
we were talking about that earlier with the restoration stuff and the consulting, right? You know, imagine being 27 and being hired at Piping Rock, right? You know, it's cool, awesome, all right, yeah, we can do that. And that doesn't happen anymore. You know, it, not to someone sort of that unproven, even then, it takes a lot, you know, a lot more experience. And you know, it's cool because it lets you know I can go look for things with like a huge amount of potential and try to, you know, that's the thing, is you kind of like look to make a little bit of that sort of dent by taking something that could be really awesome and showing people that, because it's the stuff that's really close. It's, you know, it's probably someone's already working there at this point.
Yeah. The stuff that everybody's heard of.
It's already been restored.
Exactly.
For the most part. There's still some that need it.
I'll tell you where the Wisconsin, so many courses up there just are in desperate need of tree removal.
There's plenty around here too.
It's just like what you were talking about earlier.
It's just a lot more expensive to get out here.
Yeah. Take the trees out.
Yeah.
You can get to work.
Yeah.
How much nicer is it working at home as opposed to?
It's pretty sweet. It really doesn't happen very often, but it's almost weird a little bit, because it's like there's other things going on at home, and when you're on the road, like you can be really laser focused, right? There's nothing else to do at some of these places, and you're there with the crew and the guys, and all you're doing is talking about golf and that project and how to make that better and better and all that stuff, and you're taking in that culture. But when you're at home, it's certainly having a fiance and someone to like come like at home that's not, you know, doesn't know what's going on, it makes it a little bit different. But there's nothing better than sleeping in your own bed. I end up in so many.
What's the radius for staying home? Like
Well, it's tough because I can get to Long Island in the morning when I leave at like, you know, 5 a.m. I get out there in 50 minutes, but it might take 2 hours plus in traffic to get back all the way across to, I live just on the other side of the city in Jersey. And it's like, you know, that makes you think like occasionally it might be good to stay out here, and you kind of half and half, I guess, is kind of what I did at the, with the creek, which is, again, it's like 50 minutes in the morning, but it can be, if you want to leave before 7 p.m., it's going to take you 2+ hours. So it's, you know, even it's not even a home game sometimes when it feels like it should be.
What project? I imagine that you just alluded to it with talking golf with the other guys you're working with. Like, what project sticks out? Like, when did you have the most fun time after work, or during and after work, where you go, you're done, and you just talk shop and talk architecture?
The ones that stick out the most are Dismal River.
And that was like your second one.
That was
the first one.
First construction with,
you were an intern.
Renaissance. Yeah, there was a group of like 10 of us right out there that were pretty much trapped, right? So when you're in Nebraska, there's no place there. We're all eating 3 meals together every day. We're all sleeping in rooms like right next to each other. You're working together all day long. That's just what it is. Obviously, there's more talk than just golf, but knowing me, it probably was only golf, especially if you had.
How many of the 10 are still in architecture?
I think we did this on the other one. So obviously,
oh, yeah, we talked about that.
Right. Sorry. So obviously, Tom
Blake
and Brian and
yeah,
Schneider, right? Those are obvious. Jonathan Reister, who was out there a bit with us, he still does some work, I believe. Although I think he just went back to school. So who else? Yeah, Blake, Clyde, for sure. Zach Vardy, for sure. Jeff Stein, for sure. Brett Hochstein. Ryan Yance was working at Bel Air, right? Who else? I haven't kept too much in touch with like Connor Cummings, but I've heard at points, I think he's worked with Trip at least. He's from Oklahoma. I don't know if there's anybody else currently. Like, they were still in for a while, at least if they weren't. James Bird, I guess, and Matt Hunter. Some of the other names that popped into my mind. I might be forgetting someone obvious, but it was a while ago.
it depends a lot to remember too.
But it was a awesome time and learning experience. It was a crash course in minimalism, but at the same time too, Vineyard Golf Club, my first project with Gil, well, was great. I spent a lot of time there with Kyle Franz. That's where, you know, 3 months with him talking architecture all the time. I mean, that's all we're ever going to talk about together.
you know, when Kyle calls you, it's going to be like an hour and a half conversation.
And he's driving, and you're just worried he's going to total his car on another animal at the same time. And I know he's driving with 2 feet as well, which is just so dangerous. But he thinks he's the world's greatest driver. Oh, man, he's going to kill me for saying all of this, but it'll be funny. At least I didn't get him as bad as Wagner got him on some of the other ones. Even in France with Neil, I was telling you earlier when we were walking around, he's awesome. He's one of the most talented people in the business and loves it. And we are a really great team on site. We have a lot of similar just views on life. And we had an awesome time building golf and taking in the French lifestyle this year.
That has to be just an awesome place to. It was hot though.
Yes, the French do not do air conditioning very well. But if you can get the fan situation sorted, get a sleep on the bottom floor of the house, and a lot of rosé, I think, is the key, really. It's a far worse.
When you're talking shop with other guys, you know, you're kind of like teammates when you're doing these projects, but then in the future, you guys are hopefully, you know, going to go on and build your own courses and not all be working together all the time. Like, do you have ideas that you like can't tell, you can't, like, in your head?
I think for sure. I absolutely. I'm there's everybody's got their own little secret move or something, you know? You like, yeah, of course. Maybe it just depends on how much rosé is flowing at the time as to what comes out at when. But, you know, they're all just ideas, right? Mm-hmm. And most of the ideas in this stuff have probably been, they're probably coming from somewhere, being recycled or inspired by something else anyway. So, you know, we'll see. I think there's obviously like a big thing about, you know, what's next, right? We've been on this minimal, you know, so I think there's
a next question.
There's, you know. Oh, yeah. So, you know, I certainly have ideas about what that could be. I think there's a lot of stuff with the way some of the, like, crazy technology stuff and the tools we have to do these you know, super high-end jobs now. I think there's a, you know, with the bunker liners, all these sorts of different drainage stuff, to sort of take what we have equipment wise and sort of rejigger some of the form and function stuff and try to make look at the bunkers today. It went like, it's like perfection, right? But at the same time, it's really easy to almost, if you're a good player, to hit some of that super high spinny shots out of those, you know, the Billy Bunker stuff, right? It almost makes it more moist and the sand is firmer. So a really good player can get down and like create a lot of spin. It almost makes it easier for them.
Very predictable.
So how to take, sort of react to that, right? Because I think is sort of where my mind goes. But then I also think too about, like, you know, going more in the more urban stuff, right? Certainly I live around here in the big cities, transforming sort of more urban golf courses that, or, you know, right on the outskirts, that doing more sort of small format things, and how we can just sort of, you know, go about the small format stuff a little different. The reversible stuff is really cool. The project we're doing at Edgartown with the it's a 9-hole course, but we're building a second green very much in that sort of Japanese style, so it can, they have the room for it, so they get two holes with only one fairway, right? It's two greens and two approaches, but everything else is shared. So, you know, that sort of two courses in one thing you might get in one way at the loop, you get a little bit different there. You know, so
I think 9 holes is the right amount of golf for a lot of people.
For me, 36 is barely enough in a day. So,
but I'm saying, like, in terms of like a working professional, because 9 you can like squeeze in, right? Or 4 you can squeeze in.
Yep.
I think that's the best benefit of being a member at a country club. Is the ability to go play 4 holes versus.
I proposed something recently where there was, what was it, you and Shackelford were talking about it, and I was like, man, these guys told my idea, because I had this routing for redoing it was a proposed rerouting for something. I was like, well, this place wants to be like super family friendly. They have a residential component to it. I was like, well, if you could kind of reverse some of this, all of a sudden you could have a loop of 4 holes, a loop of 5 holes, and a loop of 9 all at the same time. So it's giving the country club that, like, the starters a lot more places to send people out. You know, if it's the wife and the kids and you bought one of their like 250 homes right next door, you could go out real easy in the evenings when you get home. If the wife is, you know, just learning, and even 9's maybe a little bit too much at times, that's perfect. If you've got the kids that are just learning, you know, that's so, and you come right back. And so it's easy function, you know, it's tough on the routing to always make it work and come back to the clubhouse and stuff like that. But I think that's like, if you want to talk about like family friendly stuff and things like that, you could potentially do things like that and make it more, you know, you could sell four whole loops, five whole loops, so, and make more money out of that. Right.
I was thinking about this.
So the way that happened was, it was a 27 hole golf course being downsized to 18. So I was like, well, how do you tell these guys they're not going to lose revenue? So I was, that's how it occurred to me like that. And I was screaming at the pod when you guys were talking, like, you stole my damn idea.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right. First time, long time.
I think about a lot of stuff. You
know? Yeah.
So I want a public course to do this, yeah, where you have to have the routing right, but you could have like a 3-hole league, a 6-hole league, and a 9-hole league. And the 9-hole league, the 9-hole league starts at 5. The 6-hole league starts at, like, you know, 5:40, and right, the 3-hole league starts at 6:15. And it all depends on when you get off work, like when you can, yeah, get off work, and you go and you play, and everybody then finishes at the same time. And you have to have the routing right spots, but you could adapt this, but then everybody together and you have like drinks afterwards, and it's, well, like I couldn't get out of work in time for the 9-holer, so I did the 3-holer.
But then you got to build the putting course, but you know, right outside too, and you get the fire pit and you just keep it going with the drinks. It's perfect, man.
There's a place that's getting that I went and I started thinking about this from it, and they have a putting course right outside.
There you go.
It's funny you said that, because that's exactly what they're doing. It's like Loch LaBelle up in Wisconsin.
Awesome.
But yeah, they have a 3-hole loop, a 6-hole loop potential, and a 9-hole loop.
There you go.
It's neat. I don't know. Yeah. Sorry.
rabbit hole city.
Exactly. I mean, when you were a kid, you just started sketching golf holes, I imagine, at some point.
At some point, yes. I have a sketchbook at home with like random holes. Sometimes it's like, you know, I would just go on the early stages of Google Earth or whatever and just trace something into it and then draw over top of that, or old yardage books. I have a massive yardage book collection. So some of that sort of stuff, trying to, you know, create sort of your own sort of templates or whatever as a kid was kind of fun, I guess. I mean, that was more probably high school. I probably started doing that a little bit. But when I was really young, I was the first thing I ever wanted to do in life was be an NHL goalie. So I have sketchbooks more with like custom goalie pad setups than I do with golf courses. But it quickly changed, as you can tell. It's a one track mind here.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Beadratty. Beadratty makes some of the best golf clothes on the market. They make the best cotton. It is Pima Peruvian cotton, and there's no better place to have this soft, luxurious cotton than in your underwear. They make boxers. So I would definitely check out the Richard Boxer. I mean, there's nothing better than a great shirt from Beadratty. It's so comfortable. I get people talking about it all the time. They're like, oh God, these shirts are so comfortable. Well, imagine that in your underwear. I mean, life's too short to wear uncomfortable underwear. So Richard Boxers, you can get those on beadratty.com. They come in all different types of colors. You know, my biggest problem is Mrs. Fried Egg will steal them to sleep in them. I mean, maybe this is TMI, but highly recommend the Richard Boxer, available on beadratty.com. And now we will go back to Jaeger Kovic. Yeah, you travel, you play a ton of golf and see a lot of golf courses. Not, you might not play as much as you see courses.
I play a lot. You're not joking. All the time, but yeah, I'm addicted.
How do you go about figuring out where you're going to see stuff? Like, what could the listener that's,
well, where
take,
am I?
Well, am just I say home? Just am say I you're going to somewhere you haven't been. Like, what's the first thing you're doing?
I don't know, but see, I'm always starting off by going someplace for work, right? Yeah. I'm always, so if you're working in Pinehurst, you're obviously, I wanted to go, you know, I had to go to Roaring Gap, finally, Old Town, Salisbury, you know, that sort of.
There's so many courses in North Carolina.
Yeah. So, but if, you know, in Nebraska, you know, if you're, you can drive to Prairie Dunes, you can drive north to Sutton Bay, I guess. You can go see all of the cool mom and pop stuff in Nebraska. The little 9-hole sand hole courses are awesome. I don't know. But it's just like you're always starting from somewhere, and so I know a lot of it's, you know, we're around here, so one thing I've been trying to do at home is slowly, you know, I have lists of courses I want to see that I compile or whatever. So sometimes it's listed by state, sometimes it's like list of courses by that architect that I want to see. So I want to see, I'm trying to see as many or all of the Tillinghast stuff really, but same thing with Walter Travis. Cause he certainly did a lot of work near in my part of the country. And I'm just, he's incredible and maybe the most underrated of the American based guys. I won't call him American. He's not, but,
he did all of his work in America.
Yeah. So, and then Emmett as well. I'm trying to see kind of all of his stuff as well.
Is it Emmett or Emmett?
I don't know. You'd have to ask. There's just a new book that came out, The Naturalist, right?
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm, I think so. I want to learn more about him. So you just got to go see him, see what's left, try to piece it together.
What do you have? What are like the top of your list of places you want to see that you haven't gotten to yet?
Top of my list. Oh, we were talking earlier. Myopia Hunt is on there, and Essex, I guess, right across the street from each other.
Boston Two Step.
Yeah. Cape Arundel, the Travis course up in Maine.
I said I was going there with it this year, and I didn't.
Yeah, I said that last year. I'm lucky, right? I've seen a lot, and a lot of what I've tried is Huntercombe in the UK is the Willie Park Jr., the place that he, I guess, owned or was in developed. That place just looks absolutely fascinating. Lahinch has been at the very top of my list for the longest time.
We had a discussion earlier.
I want to go back to Japan and get everything in Australia and New Zealand. I don't know. There you go. Now we're in rabbit hole city again. And
we had a discussion earlier about architects of the golden age that did it as a hobby and what they did. And then, you know, it spawned from talking about Aiken and what a friend of ours said about how, you know, he got to build it for himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, Willie Park with Huntercombe.
Right.
He built it for himself.
Yeah.
And there's like,
I was just writing about the Addington the other day for the eclectic thing. Right. And the Abercrombie was the same thing there. It's like Pine Valley or, I've thought about it. I don't know how I can afford that perfect, you know, sandy coast or even, you know, whatever. Honestly, it'd be cool. I've dreamt about just like somehow being able to take over like a few of these courses here in the like just as really close into the city and being able to take those over, do something really cool and just sort of like a awesome 9-hole course, a 9-hole par 3 course, and just a killer driving range, and just being able to like show people kind of what you could do, like, you know.
Well, and in Pine Valley, greatest course in the country, everybody says that was built by a guy, you mm-hmm. know, like the guy. It was all a vision, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, he got a lot of help, but he built it for him, like, you know.
Yeah, but I don't know. But when you're out there on the machine, I'm not thinking about what. That I'm just trying to make everything, you know, make love of the dirt, right? Just give it. I'm just like that anyways. I'm going to pretend like it's mine no matter what and take to do the super high quality, best work. You got to believe that, like, or just you're doing it because you love to do it. And, you know, you take so much ownership of it. I think I don't think it'd really be any different. If people are going to trust me to do that, I'm going to do it the same. There's no, like, what would I do on my own? Maybe not as much. It would be maybe a little bit more out there, I suppose, you know, but I guess it depends on your client too at that rate. You know, what are they looking for? Everybody has something, but yeah, but honestly, I just get dropped off on a bulldozer or an excavator. It's like, okay, you know, very little verbal instructions sometimes. And it's like, here you go. Okay. Make something cool. So once you're there in the machine, it feels almost the same at that rate, right?
What
does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Like once you get into it,
right? Once you're there, you got to make it yours.
Mm-hmm.
You know that.
Because it is like you do have ownership because it's your.
Yeah, and then it's turned over to the, you know, contractor, to the club, to seed, or you know, whatever, and then it's somebody else's. But until then, that's ours to make. Make it is the most fun golf you could possibly create out of it, right?
What's your pet peeve in architecture?
Oh,
it could be any type. I'm just curious. What when you see just drives you nuts?
One of my favorite. I just love the way golf holes look in the dirt. Just like. Tracked in with the track marks and the blade marks from how, you know, the machine or the bucket marks,
mm-hmm. From smashing down.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like different ways to run the machine. You know, there's a lot of guys. Tapper. So like you can normally hear me
I
from
like
across.
The tapper.
Yeah, it's really loud. The guys that rent you the machine don't like you because you're beating the hell out of the thing. So sorry, Matt and Rich and everybody else.
I'm sure
else.
They're making their money on those rentals.
It's all right. They'll.
It's got character.
If you go fast enough, they'll forgive you. But when it's got all those fresh bucket marks and all those tracks on it, and then someone comes ripping up on a cart or something and just lays just tire tracks like right down the line of sight. It's like, don't touch it. It's just so perfect right now. But it's obviously an inevitable part of the process. That is my least favorite. I'm sure, I've gotten probably way too upset at a few people for just running something up. But it just is what it's not, you know, all right, we'll fix it. No big deal. Well, it's got to be perfect at the end. And that's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I always like seeing like a sprig course.
Oh no, sprigs are the worst. Sprigs is the worst process to watch because you're out there and like, you know, I probably said it, make love to the dirt, right? You put this perfect finish on it. You make so it's like, you know, we're literally talking fractions of an inch, you know, with almost all of the features, right? And then, you know, certain like the surface of a green, right? You know, we'll hand rake the green and then you know what how you sprig, you get a bunch of guys to just come trample everything, you know, walk all over it by hand after you've just raked every footprint off of the thing. They're going to then walk all across it, put out all their fur, then take all these sprigs, throw them all over the place and just have a dance party across it. Then they're going to come by and slice it in, and then they're going to crimp it in and roll it in. And somehow it always goes back perfectly but it is don't ever watch anything.
I don't
you've
like
ever
I've never
built.
Seen something
just
sprint. I like when it's just after and the grass
bentgrass,
starts popping up.
Yeah. I love the color of hydromulch. That's a beautiful sight.
Maybe that's sprigging. What I like. I don't even know what
sprigging is the worst. The finish like pre-seed, because northern grass like bentgrass fescue. The finish work you have to do has to be ultra precise because that won't tolerate it, right? It'll stay in that forever. But the process with the sprigging, with all that herd of elephants and the whole circus that goes on after, you know, so if it's you know, you want to get it to absolutely perfect, but there's different tolerances because of what you do after in the next step of the process. So, and then I try to finish everything like it's bent anyways, right? You got to make, he's got to make it perfect. You get one chance. You get one chance, then the grass goes on and it's done. Then it costs a whole lot more to take it apart. So one chance, got to make it perfect.
That's true. Yeah. The finality of design is like kind of a scary thing.
You don't want to dig stuff back up.
What's like the most nervous you've been on a project or like building something? Have you ever felt like, I really don't want to screw this up?
I know for sure I'm already nervous about doing that hole at Edgartown in the spring, just because it's so unique and the landform is so amazing already. And that'll be the first, probably the first, definitely the first green I've ever fully, you know, executed on my own. Entirely green expansion is one thing, but yeah, to build an entirely new green on, that's a huge step.
Your design.
Correct.
You know,
not, so that's, yeah. But in the past,
you've built a lot of greens from nothing, but
I wouldn't say a lot, you know, certainly that's, you know, Gil or Jim or say Eric Iverson when I was working for Tom or Brian, those who were the guys building most of the greens. Uh-huh. We've definitely built, you know, we do a lot of sort of everything else and we certainly tweak things here, there, certainly built a good handful of them. Certainly in the last year, it's been more and more. That's what we were talking about earlier. That was the amazing thing about France is I've built more greens for them in France than I probably did in the 4 years prior working with them. So that's what made that. That's why you.
No brainer.
Right. Yeah. Aside from the rosé, right. Yeah. But, and the duck, but, Aranim Inc. was very nerve wracking. Going into that was probably the most nervous I'd ever been because the amount we had to recreate for that restoration. I mean, it was going from 70 something bunkers to like 182, I believe, that they're out there right now. So entire landforms needed to be totally recreated and some ultra artistic, just mind-blowingly cool stuff. And we had tons of photographic evidence of what it exactly was like, but I felt pretty nervous being in the everyday guy there and being the one that was tough, but very proud of how it turned out.
Speaking of, like, in your mind, what's the line? I feel like, you know, certain places should always, you know, like, given their space in the game, like, it's a no-brainer, restore. Mm. And a lot of stuff has gotten restored, but like, when's it right to not restore and to renovate maybe a hole or change a routing or of a, especially a classic golf course, like a golden age design?
I think, you know, I don't know. It's something you don't want to get in a necessarily pattern of doing, but I think it's a circumstantial thing. So, only to just pull from like an actual experience, right? So there's a couple places like that. I think in the future we kind of hope to do at Suburban, right? It's a 1922 Tillinghast course. It was built 10 minutes down the street from Baltusrol the same year. So there's tons of incredible stuff out there, but there's also, it's a very tight place. It's a small property. There's a lot of linear nature it required to get sort of through. But there's a shortish par five there that's got 500 yards of property line and fence up the right. And over time, it's become trees on the left side, which is narrowing the thing. And there's really, you know, was really never any, it was just a straight 500 yard hole until it got to the green, and the green had changed. The green's been changed by a golf pro I don't know, 30, 50 years ago. It's just a pancake.
The Cofpro.
Right.
The just Cofpro flattened it. Change. It's just
but that's a place where, you know, they have already a pattern of these really cool sort of shared hazards, and we need to do something to try to pull the interest left instead of right where they have the boundary issue. That's a place where you could sort of get into do. They already have shared hazards on a number of holes. So if we could do something like connect some fairway a little bit with the 17 on the left of it, do some cool shared hazards. And I've kind of thought too, since the green sort of, you know, that's a place where maybe you could add a little bit more of the, oh, it's, you could maybe start to think about doing some, you know, Tillinghast did a lot of writing and sketching of template holes, especially the par fives. He, you know, double dog leg.
Great hazard.
Right. So that's something there where we've sort of just batted around that idea. We haven't done anything with it, but that's something kind of kicking in the back of our heads for down the road. So that's a place I kind of look to is, you know, there's, it's just 500 yards of straight. This is
so
a place
pancake.
Where kind of, yeah. But not Tilly's, so.
Yeah, yeah. It's that's a tricky thing.
There's also like. Places, too, where if there's, like, a functionality thing, right? So if it's – there's
– drainage.
Correct. Circumstances have changed, and it's flooding, and you have to move something, right? You know, then what do you do? Shade, safety, things like that. Those are always obvious ones, but, you know, sometimes – I don't want to change the crazy stuff. I like, you know, the wild stuff. I'm always going to probably lean to, oh, keep that. That's the cool stuff. But like the stuff that, you know, I don't know. I think there's sometimes a lot of room for improvement and things are always evolving. So you just got to work at it. Oh, I guess circumstance. But at the same, I'm pretty strict on myself with the restoration stuff. I don't know. I'm pretty, I think you kind of have to be, there's a lot of gray area in what restoration is. So I just try to be pretty clear and try to, if we're going to be really authentic, I want to do that. If there's no reason to do that, then what do we do? Is it just something that's influenced or is it a total, I don't know. There's a lot of ways that it's to sort of spin it at the same time.
Yeah. It's kind of got like a dividing line, and then like as you get some in edge of the spectrum, and you know, it's very a delicate situation.
Yeah, but you know, I there's always been a pattern. I think you know when there's real history and there's real something to tie into, I think there's something really cool about having that same sort of experience and the. People have been playing golf here for 100 years and that sort of same thing. I think there's a lot to that. I think we have that throughout our culture, right? That sort of, you know, antiques are a thing for a reason, right? People love that sort of stuff. The sort of vintage clothing, the, you know, all our kitchen appliances look like they're, you know, they have the very sort of historic sort of thing to them. I think it's, you know, the way you kind of, you know, what did mom do right at home? So there's always a, draw, I think, to that culturally, and it. I don't know.
Hey, I haven't done overrated underrated in like a year.
Wow!
You want to do some overrated underrated?
Maybe. We'll see. I guess go for it.
Rainer.
Currently trending overrated, probably, and that he didn't make the Rushmore. He didn't make Mount Rushmore. For me, so
he didn't even get mentioned.
Yeah, how about that?
It's kind of unbelievable. I always am amazed at the fact that he didn't even know what golf was until.
How about that, right?
McDonald. You know,
McDonald, I think, would be closer to Rushmore than Rainer, in my mind.
Yeah.
The impact, right?
Impact is insane. Rainer, the thing that I'm amazed about. Is that
Andy's favorite rabbit hole?
I've said this a lot, but I think his best holes are the non-template holes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's fine.
You know?
Yeah.
But you know, so it's hard to pick four.
Listen, I love it. I was super pumped about Francis Byrne the other day, right? I mean, I love it. Right. Of course. Yeah. But the whole, you know, I love the tempo. Like, I love the, you know, the world needs more leaving holes as far as I'm concerned, or no, like, really good no hole. But at the same time, too, that's the only thing the world seems to be talking about right now.
It is.
I'm just a little, I want to be different, man. I just, like, you can do something different.
I don't post pictures for likes, like, and stuff. But I know when I post, like, some fresh new Rainer photos that the internet is going to, like, love them. It is so weird. I don't know what it is about. I think it's because people have seen it before, right?
Yes, it's recognizable. And so they're easy to understand because you can, okay, well, this whole, the strategy of it is like this, and it's sort of told to you and it's explained to you so you can relate it back to that and you can break it down. And it's like, you know, that's the, if you were going to teach an architecture 101 thing, almost like tons of that stuff would be in there, right? That's, you know, the most copied hole in golf is the Redan, right? How would that not be, you know, you'd have that discussion of what is that and how does it look here? How is it there? Is this one, you know? So it's just relatable. People can get it. And that's great. You know, I started like that too. Like, of course. But then the more and more, sometimes it's like, all right, you know, I'd love to go to Camargo. That's really high on my list. But like the same time too, you know, it's difference good too. You
know, yeah. I know. I
like to zig, but not, you know.
I like the most influential golf course in my life is a Rainer, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that's why, like, you know, that's like the place where like a light bulb went off for me.
Yeah.
So I think that's obviously always something that I, you know, and it's, but like as I've seen more and more,
everybody
and more
gets
stuff,
right.
Like,
I just said overrated, and I cannot tell you how excited I am to go play Yale tomorrow. Like,
yeah,
just through the, like, so I say that, but it's essentially, you know, it's just a temperature of the room answer, I suppose, you know, or culture, you know.
Yeah,
I'd probably hate him even more if I was on Twitter, but I'm not gonna do that. So
the group. I'm not making any
comments.
That's a subject.
I got too many opinions to be on Twitter, so we're not going to do that.
I used to reply, and I used to be, mm-hmm. you know, but I'm done now. I don't like getting in the mentions anymore. It's you know, the social media has been overall really good for architecture.
Yeah.
But I think it also creates this like groupthink, and mm-hmm. in a way can stunt the progression, because, you know, becomes this gospel of this is good. And like, I feel like sometimes it's like, this is good, this is bad. It's like, if it's, you know, what you guys do is art, you know, there should be a wide range of opinions, right?
Yeah.
This is a big topic, you know.
Yeah, this is only gonna get me in terrible trouble too. Oh man, how do I find my way through here? I don't
this
know
this might it's, be a topic for another day.
It's hard to give like honest critique, especially someone in my place, right? Because, you know, I do this so I have a very critical eye. And so I always just get frustrated because as an art, you know, I went to school, I was an architecture major, I was a studio art minor, you know, critique was everything, right? So I insist on critique on site. I want to know, you know, those we were talking about earlier, like having Kyle on site, he's going to, you know, ask him, you know, I like what this is doing, I like what that's doing, did you ever think about this, what about that? That's how we learn, you know. Yeah. You know, when your professor in college stands up and she friggin' rips your model in half, and like you thought you were going to walk in and get an A, and then you just have to stand up there and present something, and all of a sudden you're getting slaughtered, and it's like, here's your C-, this is trash, like, what were you thinking? Like, So that's the only way I think we can learn. But you need that to push everything forward, because if everything is simply the just like it, everything, the newest is always the best. It's not the best. It's just so that's we need that. I don't know how you get that. I know it's very difficult to critique the other guy in the same business. As, like, I get it. It's a weird ground. It's hard to do right. And not so, offend everybody, and thus you, no Twitter.
You were critical. I'm of ultra. Me.
Yes, very early on.
Like early on, and yeah, but, you know, but it made me better. And like Tommy Nakarado was really critical of me on some. On,
and I
on
just
an
saw
article.
Him defend you very, yeah. very well the other but, day. But and he's and that's
so many people
he
take
hit
offense.
On exactly the same thing that you know you took it, but then you like. You got on a plane, you came here, and you're standing in the dark waiting for the sun come up to take photos of you know, well, places that no one's ever heard of. You drove 2 hours out of your way to go to Galen Hall because to go like a moat hole. Like, there's not many people that would do so.
But this is the thing. Not, Tommy, like, he like shredded me.
Oh,
about
I'm
an
sure
article.
He sent it a was, gazillion messages to Gil and Jim. Well, what is this kid?
But I called him, I talked to him, mm-hmm. and what he said, he's like, you know, like you just need to do your homework. Like you didn't do your, and he was totally right. And it's like, it changed, but like, and this is the thing that kind of can drive me nuts a little bit about the internet, because like, if you say something critical about something somewhere, people like think you hate it. And it's like, well, no, I'm just pointing out like one thing.
Yeah.
And if somebody doesn't point it out, how do you ever know that might right. I'm not necessarily
and then the, if it, yeah. the thing too is, you know, if someone if I want to talk about the functionality stuff or yeah. how something was constructed, no one in the world is going to understand that, and then they're just like, oh, you're saying all this, but
like horizon but lines I can, be something that
but I, it's bad too, because I can be really negative or be really critical of a really small thing, but overall the thing was actually excellent. And I find that's often I really, really like something, and you know say it's like a Doke, you know, I might give something a Doke 7, but I might rant and rave about a couple of things that are just driving me nuts out there, and like everybody, but I was like, you know, and I might be fascinated about it and just go on and on and on, and no, it's like, what are you talking? I'm like, it's still an awesome golf course, like, don't get me wrong, but there's something about the way that this thing is that just gets at me, and I don't have a place to explain that, because that's how people learn. And you know, I just want to teach people more, and it's hard to be. You have to be sometimes critical. You don't necessarily be overly negative, but frank, and it's tough to find that. And then, you know, it's tough some always to find. You know, well, what good is it going to do if you just I don't know. So it's tough. I loved, well, listen, I'm Golf Club Atlas is riddled of things like that I've said over the years. And but that's more of that discussion thing, for whatever reason, that, you know, where I spend most time on social media is like Instagram. Right. And there's not nearly that conversation.
I mean,
there.
On Instagram, it's all like,
it's like the photos,
roses, right? And it drives me insane sometimes. Because like, to me, like, but everywhere can't be the greatest in the world, because if everywhere's the greatest, then what is the greatest?
Correct. Yes.
Then like, how do you ever know if it is the greatest, if you say everything's the greatest?
Yep. I struggle with this all of the time.
Yeah. But then you start
Listen,
talking about like,
you're talking things, to yeah. someone that's worked on a lot of these super, you know, incredible places that are, you know, a lot of them are these courses you're talking about. I don't know how to, like, you know, I it's great to have the positive, it's amazing, but how does it really, you know, sometimes it's too soon. You just got to see how things level off.
Well, and that's the thing is like, so many courses, you got to see how they mature too, right? And you can't judge. It's so hard to judge.
Golf courses are living, breathing, evolving things.
And like one loop around, I found this with especially national golf links. Like, the first time I played it.
Had you ever walked it before?
No.
So, see, when I went, so I walked the golf course probably three times before I ever played it. So yeah. I'd call Bill, I'd send Bill an email, and I'd go out there in February. I'd be out there at like 7 a.m. because I got to beat the traffic all the way out to the Hamptons, right? And then I'd come back, I'd walk the whole thing, probably take me 6 hours. I'd have 600 photographs for the day. You know, the bunkers have pallets in them or like things like that for the winter. There's no flags. It doesn't matter. And, you know, so like I was able to take every, and I probably did that two or three times over the course of, and then finally one time, you know, somehow I, you know, it was nice enough to have me out there. It was, oh man, I played with Ben Hillard. It was the windiest. It was literally, there was a tropical storm off the coast of Long Island. We were the only people to play the golf course that day. But, you know, you wouldn't have had that, you know, experience. It was pretty funny. There were like literally two TaylorMade reps in the shop with us. It was the four of us in the morning, and they were trying to wait it out. And we were like, all right, let's go for it. They never went out. We played the only people on the golf course that whole day. But I smashed a best drive and best three wood of my life and barely got pin high on 17. So that tells you how much wind there was.
That's a lot of wind.
That's a lot of wind.
The yeah, so the first time I played,
yeah,
my buddy was like, what did you think? I'm like, you know, honestly, I can't even tell you because I'm like kind of like my I'm on a total sensory overload.
You couldn't take it in.
Like the second time I played, I like saw I'd noticed a lot more stuff. Like,
yeah.
And then the third time I was there, I played with like a hickory and a persimmon or a hickory driver and a Bellotta ball.
Mm.
And it was like insane.
Yeah.
You know, like all of a sudden I saw so much more than I'd ever.
So you're
like,
about that restoration movement.
The 17th tee was the most, and like this, everybody talks about how great 17 is, right? Yeah. And playing modern, it's not a great hole for me because I just blast it up the left.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no thought. Like, but then all of a sudden I have a hickory and a Bellotta in my hand.
Right.
And all of a sudden I saw so that's, many more bunkers. Right.
That's what the principal's nose really was, wasn't it? It was like a three-dimensional hazard when you had to try to get the old hickory stuff airborne.
Yeah.
Because that, so it was like a
vertical hazard.
Correct. Right.
And all of a sudden, the 17th, I had this like, I was like, oh. Like, I got why it was cool, but I at the same time, I'm like, nobody can call this the greatest par four in the world right now. Because, like, with modern equipment, you just hit it over it, you know, and it's not the design's fault, you know, it's the governing body's fault, but like, it's not like, you know, it, by today's standard, it's, you know, sadly not the, but then all of a sudden with the old equipment, I'm like, but I appreciate that more. And then people are like, when are you going to write about this place? And I'm like, frankly, I'm not even ready to write about it. What am I going to write? What am I going to add to the subject right now?
Yeah.
Because I haven't even seen, and I don't know enough about it, you know? Certain places you can, you know, shed light on early on that people haven't provided
the insight. The place is a museum. You could write about so many different things. There's like every kind of bunker on the, ever, you know, imagined is somewhere out there already, right?
17, the bunker with the top, I mean.
That's why, you know, then the next McKellar, the ode to the trench bunker.
Yeah. This the inverted bunkers at Garden City are
well they're out there at National
yeah too. It's I inverted bunkers need to come back. I saw
we were talking earlier, right, the sort of, you know, the future, right, the change, the reaction to the other stuff. Well, there you go.
Inverted bunkers,
you don't need Billy Bunker for that, right?
Are so cool. And anybody that doesn't know what an inverted bunker is, like literally just think about flipping a bunker
it's
over
like a mound
and then just
sand.
Put it, yeah, mound with sand on top of it.
Yeah. I like the cool ones at certainly at Garden City where it's like deep bunker and then it's got something in the middle and then it goes to the, it's got the trifecta, right? The inverted and then the middle stage and then the like deep cavern all in like a, triplet right there. Those are so Walter Travis was just brilliant with his creation of features, but I think we only got one overrated, underrated, and then you just ran away, man.
It's time. Discussion.
I'm glad you brought that back. Though. I feel honored to have participated in that.
You know, it's a good, because it just jumps you into these topics.
Yeah,
right. Look at the rabbit hole it led us into.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is enough. You know, this is the second end.
It's gonna be just sheer delusional golf nerd stuff after this.
Thanks for coming on for the second time. All right, people can find you on Instagram, Proper Golf at Proper Golf.
Yeah,
and they can read all your stuff on the Fried Egg. You've written a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff. We're 14 weeks up, right? I think today or yesterday, 14 went up, right? From the old course Clyde wrote about. So coming down the stretch.
Yeah, you got to be like the fifth most contributing author on the Fried Egg.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm gonna remember that one of these days when it. You better be careful. Now we got photographs too. Uh-oh.
This is
you're just giving me ammo to yeah, perfect.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, and look forward to seeing Edgartown.
Yeah,
get out there.
Awesome. Definitely nothing wrong with day playing golf in Martha's Vineyard.
There's always time for 9 or 18.
You got to play both 7 and 16.